Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Shannon Brownlee, the Schwartz Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation and author of Overtreated, Why Too Much Medication is Making Us Sicker and Poorer. Her topic will be the cost of health care. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, October 27, 2010, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the College of St. Mary, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Christine Farr, Vice President for Academic Affairs at the College of St. Mary.
I would like to welcome you to this evening's presentation by our 2010 Woodrow Wilson Visiting Scholar, Shannon Brownlee. The Woodrow Wilson Visiting Scholar Program allows colleges and universities to bring scholars of international renown to campus for a week of engagement on topics of interest to the collegiate and the local community. This year's scholar, Ms. Brownlee, is a Schwartz Senior Fellow at the New American Foundation, which is a think tank out of Washington, D.C., whose purpose is to bring exceptionally promising new voices and new ideas to the fore of the nation's public discourse. They invest in individuals who have demonstrated the ability and the desire to move public thinking into new territories. Ms. Brownlee is a renowned author and an accomplished journalist. She's won numerous journalism awards, including the Association of Healthcare Journalists Award for Excellence in Healthcare Journalism, the Victor Cohn Prize for Excellence in Medicinal Science Reporting, the National Association of Science Writers Science in Society Award, and the Sigma Delta Chi Award from the Society of Professional Journalists. She has published in a variety of venues, including the Atlantic Monthly, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times, to mention just a few. Her book, entitled Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer, has been named the best economics book of the year by the New York Times. And you will note that in the entryway that her book is on sale, and Shannon will be signing them after her presentation this evening. If this evening's presentation is anything like some of the others that I have heard this week, I'm certain that you will be captivated and that she will challenge you on some ideas that you may have previously held. Please join me in welcoming Shannon Brownlee to present to us on the cost of healthcare.
Thank you. Thank you very much. My apologies to those who've already heard me speak because, you know, I only have so many stories to tell. And so you may have heard the stories. And I almost regret that the New York Times called it the best economics book of the year because it's not an economics book. It's a book about healthcare, and it's a book about stories, and it's a book about helping people sort of set their own experiences into the larger context of what's really going on in healthcare. And I want you to know I wrote it for my mom. And my mom is really smart, but she's not a policy wonk. And I have to say that now that I'm at a think tank, and I'm also at another think tank at Dartmouth, the Institute for Health Policy, I am a certified bona fide wonk. But I wrote a book that I hope that ordinary people would want to read and would find compelling. So I'm almost sorry that the New York Times called it the best economics book because it's really, I'm not an economist and it's not really an economics book. So we finally did it. We finally got healthcare reform. And it was a pretty rough road, if you remember the last 12 months leading up to the passage of the bill. It was a lot of anger, a lot of rancor, a lot of wild stories about what healthcare reform really was going to mean from both the right and the left. A lot of exaggeration. But it's really quite an historic moment. Not many people realize that we've been trying to get, well, some people have been trying to get universal coverage in this country since the days of Teddy Roosevelt. President Barack Obama is the eighth president who has tried to get some kind of health care reform passed. Teddy Roosevelt tried, Franklin Roosevelt, Eisenhower, Truman, Nixon, Kennedy, Johnson. Johnson was there during the passage of Medicare, the failed Clinton health care debacle, and finally this latest effort. Now, it was certainly a tough go. We heard a lot of things that were not necessarily true, were exaggerations. I can tell you that there are not going to be death panels, government death panels. There was a lot of anger during the town hall meetings. A lot of stuff was flying around. I remember being on a plane, and a little tiny plane with about 8 people, and there was a guy sitting next to me, and he told me absolutely for certain the reason our health care is so expensive is because of all the illegal immigrants getting free care in emergency rooms. But my favorite line of all time was at a town hall meeting when a woman said, "I don't want the federal government touching my Medicare." So, is the bill a perfect bill, or is it perfect legislation? Absolutely not. It's not. Is it going to cover everybody? No, it's not. Is it going to ration care? No, it's not. It's really not going to ration care. If by rationing care you mean, is it going to deny people care that could help them? Is it going to deny people care that could lengthen their lives, make their lives better? Absolutely not. It's not going to do that. No death panels. It will cover a lot more people. It will begin to whittle away at costs, and it will cause turmoil in hospitals and physicians and all kinds of places, the insurance industry. And that's probably a good thing, because everybody needs to be shaken up. Everybody needs to make changes. But most of the debate has focused on the problem of coverage. How do we make sure that everybody in the United States gets basic health care and has access, can afford health insurance, can either get covered by their employer or can afford insurance themselves? That's where most of the focus has been. But it turns out that that's really not the entire legislation. That's only about half of the legislation. The other half of the legislation is aimed at what's called the delivery system, the dysfunctional, disorganized, inefficient, wildly expensive delivery system. And I have to tell you, I've started to realize that when I say the words delivery system, that you know everybody in Wonkville understands. Delivery system, some people scratching their heads thinking, delivery system, you mean the post office, which is also kind of dysfunctional and not very effective and inefficient. But by delivery system, what I mean in healthcare is the way that we deliver care. I mean all of the people, the doctors, the nurses, the orderlies, the pharmacists, the hospital administrators, the insurance executives, the people, the industries, bed makers, hospitals, syringe makers, latex glove makers, all of the various industries and people who are involved in delivering care. That's the delivery system. And some people say it's not really a system because it's completely disorganized for the most part, but we call it the delivery system, and that is what really, really needs to change. And that's the hard part of the problem, because when you think about it, covering everybody is really a matter of finding the money. But getting the delivery system to change, this $2.4 trillion industry, is like taking a bunch of tuna fish and trying to turn the QE2. It is a gigantic industry that needs to change dramatically. So what I want to talk about is mostly this part of the legislation, sort of why we need to make these changes and what changes need to occur. So I try to ask this question every time. How many people are actually delivering care? Nurses, physicians? So quite a few. Great. How many people have had experience as patients or as family members of patients who are seriously ill? A lot of people. So many of you have seen the system from the inside. Now, what happens, I think, for all of us is that we may see things happen on the inside that seem dysfunctional, that seem wrong, that don't make it easy for us to deliver the best care that we can. And we think, oh, well, this is an isolated problem. This is an isolated instance. This is just happening to me or my family. And in fact, it's part of a larger problem. It's happening all the time. And that's part of what I want to talk about today. So, and one way to talk about that is to address some of the ways, some of the assumptions that we have about healthcare. I call them healthcare zombies. They're ideas that won't die. They're bad notions. They're incorrect things that won't die. They're bad ideas or bad solutions that will not die. And my son is 15, and he's not into zombies or werewolves or what is it, vampires. Everybody's really into. So I don't really know what kills zombies. Somebody want to tell me, wooden stakes or garlic or something like that. But I think information is what we're going to kill these zombies with. So how many people think we have the best healthcare in the world? Sorry, you're alone. Usually it's a lot more people. So do we have the best healthcare in the world? We certainly have the most expensive healthcare in the world by a long shot. We spend about 2.5 times per capita more than Western European countries spend. We have very, very expensive healthcare. Does anybody know how much we spent last year on healthcare? Billions? $2.4 trillion. $2.4 trillion in $10 bills goes around the earth 9,000 times. $2.4 trillion dwarfs how much we spend on defense. It is a phenomenal amount of money. It is 18% of our gross domestic product. It is a lot of money. So we spend the most, but I don't think that by any measure we actually have the best healthcare in the world when you look at other countries. So one of the measures of whether or not the healthcare is doing what it's supposed to do is looking at life expectancy at birth. So our life expectancy at birth is something like 78 point something years. Most of Western Europe is 79, 80, 81. So we're not doing that well. Well, some people say, oh, well, that's a really unfair measure because we have homicides and car accidents. True, but if you take out all the homicides and car accidents, we go up to 79 years, and we're still not the best. So we're spending 2.5 times more, and we're not getting life expectancy out of it. And when you look at things like infant mortality, we're number 23. And then people say, oh, well, that's because we have so many teenage births. We have so many underweight births. Well, why do we have those? We're apparently not doing something in terms of public health to try to reduce the number of babies that are underweight. So within any measure that you look at, when you look at specific diseases, are we living longer when we have heart disease? No. Are we living longer when we have specific diseases like cancer? Not really. And we're certainly not getting that kind of outcome, that kind of health, considering how much we spend. So I don't think we have the best healthcare in the world. But even when you just look in the United States, 50 to 90,000 people die each year because of medical error. 90,000 people die each year because of an infection that they got in the hospital. 106,000 people die each year from an adverse event from a drug. That means nobody made a mistake. The drug has a certain number of people that it's going to hurt, and 106,000 people. So when you add it all up, healthcare itself is the third leading cause of death in this country. Now, some of that can't be gotten rid of. There's going to be a certain number of deaths that happen just because it's unpredictable. That things like you can't always tell how many people are going to, who's going to be affected badly by a drug. But some of them are avoidable. Nosocomial infection. Infection you get in the hospital is something that we could reduce dramatically. So if we have the best health care in the world, oh my goodness, Lord help the rest of the world. So we have expensive health care. We're not doing as well as we ought to, considering how much we spend. Infant mortality, life expectancy, etc. So then there's another health. So that's a healthcare zombie. We have the best healthcare in the world. I don't think we really do. Another healthcare zombie. Who pays for healthcare? So how many people are insured by their employer? How many people are insured who are covered by Medicare? So, and how many people actually pay out of pocket? So a certain number of people are actually paying out of pocket. So for those who are not paying out of pocket, and it's your insurer, your employer that's paying. Do you think your CEO is reaching into their pocket to pay for your health insurance? They're not. We are all paying for health care. We pay out of our pockets. So when you pay a copay or you pay your portion of the insurance, you perceive that piece of the health care that you're paying. But in reality, you are paying for all of it. Because you're paying in terms of lost wages. Your employer is taking money that they might have paid you in wages and putting that towards health insurance. And then we're paying more because we're paying for taxes, and taxes pay for Medicare and Medicaid. So in the end, we are all paying for this $2.4 trillion that we spend on health care. So that amounts to about $8,000 per person per year. So a family of four is actually coming up with, on average, $32,000 a year. That's more than we pay for mortgages on average. It's an enormous amount of money. We are the ones who are paying for our health care. So one of the problems is that we sort of perceive that it's somebody else who's paying for it. And it's free, but it isn't free. We are paying for it. So healthcare zombie number three, why is our healthcare so expensive? It's a very complex problem. Why are healthcare so expensive? But we tend to want to demonize certain people. So we want to say it's greedy insurers. That if we could just get rid of the insurance, so if you're on the left, you say, if we could just get rid of the insurance industry, we could get rid of the inefficiency of the insurance industry, we could get rid of the profit in the insurance industry, we would reduce the spending, we would reduce our spending on healthcare dramatically. Well, let's really just think about that. Single-payer systems like Canada spend about 15% on overhead, on sort of paper pushing. And our private insurance industry spends about 30%, 20 to 30% on overhead. So let's say we could magically make our private insurance industry as efficient as the Canadian system. How much would we actually save? We'd save about $150 billion a year. $150 billion out of $2.4 trillion just doesn't strike me as a way to save a huge amount of money. Even if you made every insurance executive make only, you know, $50,000 a year, you would not really save very much. So the problem is not just greedy insurance. And in fact, then the other one that I hear a lot is greedy hospital administrators. And yeah, hospital administrators generally make a lot more than even the top paid doctor. But if we got rid of all the hospital administrators, we wouldn't save that much money. That's not really what the problem is. The problem is not you can think of healthcare. So healthcare is this sort of vacuum that's sucking up money, $2.4 trillion. And the insurance industry is the hose. It's conveying the money from all of us into the healthcare sector. And the hose is taking its percentage, but the vacuum part is the delivery system. It is all of the industries that are involved in healthcare. It is all of the people that are involved in healthcare. So going after the insurance industry is really not going to solve our cost problem. So healthcare zombie number four. On the left, you hear the solution to the problem is single-payer system. Well, we have a single-payer system. It's called Medicare. And Medicare has all the same problems as the private system. And on the right, what you hear is the solution to our healthcare cost problems is that patients need more skin in the game. Patients need to pay more. They need to feel the actual economic sting of paying for the care. And when people say that, I think they can't possibly know any real patients. Because what they're assuming is that patients are demanding all this care. And yeah, you know, patients do demand a certain amount of care. I mean, I've been in the emergency room where a patient comes in. Well, the patient is the child, and the mother comes in, and the child fell off the couch and hit his head on the carpet, and the mother says, "I know my kid needs a CT scan. You need to CT scan his head." So patients do demand a certain amount of care. But the fact is that the vast majority of what we spend is spent on people who are chronically ill. There's this thing called the 80-20 rule in healthcare policy. 20% of the people account for 80% of the spending, and that 20% of people have chronic illnesses, and most of the spending on them is when they're in the hospital. And people who are in the hospital are generally not sitting up in bed and saying, I want an MRI and I want it now. The care that they are being given is being decided upon more by physicians and by what the hospital has invested in. So, yes, I think that patients do need to have more skin in the game in some cases, but that's not going to sort of magically solve our problem if everybody has, you know, 20, 30, 40% copays or $10,000 deductibles. That's not going to solve our care, our cost problem. So, what is driving our incredibly expensive care? One of the things that we don't think about very much, although we're thinking about it increasingly, is the problem of unnecessary care. And it is a huge problem. Out of that $2.4 trillion, anywhere from 20 to 30% of it is spent on care that is not benefiting patients. That's $800 billion a year. It is an enormous amount of care. And the thing that really strikes me about that care is not just the cost, the dollar cost, but the cost to patients. Because that care not only is not doing patients good, but it often causes harm. And this is really the crux of the problem. And the hardest part is going to be figuring out how we kind of weed out this part of the waste in the system. Because for one thing, one man's waste is another man's revenue stream. Somebody is making money on that waste. And in general, they're not thinking, oh, how can I give people lots and lots of care that they don't need so that I can enrich myself. It's happening because the system is disorganized. It's happening because a lot of what we deliver, we don't really know what works and what doesn't. But we know that an enormous amount of the care that's being delivered in this country is really useless care and unnecessary care and potentially harmful care. So that's really what I want to talk about a little bit more today. And I will give you an example of why it matters so much. It really matters to patients. So this was a case that happened in New York City. And it was a man who had AIDS. He was about my age, and he was in the end stages of AIDS. And he was too demented to really be able to direct his own care. He had absolutely no family. He was in a nursing home. He was alone. And he was having trouble breathing, and he had a little bit of a fever, and so the nursing home sent him to the emergency room at a hospital, at a Manhattan hospital. And at the emergency room, this man was so thin. I mean, he was really, really at the end stages. He was so thin they couldn't even get the EKG leads to stick to his chest. His skin was so thin. And he was having a little bit of trouble breathing, and they put him on a ventilator. And for those of you who are in clinical medicine, you know what this is, but for those who aren't, a ventilator is a machine that helps you breathe. So they put him on a ventilator. Now, this was an enormously expensive and in the end, very painful thing to do, because while he was on the ventilator, he couldn't turn over, and he inevitably developed a bed sore, a really serious bed sore. And he was in the hospital for several more weeks, and then he died. But he died in pain, because this bed sore was pretty bad. So the question is, why was he put on a ventilator? Now, the state of New York has a law that says a doctor may not withhold life-saving care from a patient who is incompetent to decide their own, to make decisions about their own care and has no advance directive and has no next of kin to make decisions. Now, the treatment of AIDS has gone a long ways, but you cannot save a person who's at the end stages. So this ventilator, this time on the ventilator, was not really going to save this man's life. It certainly prolonged his life, and it prolonged it in a very unpleasant way. But the physicians might say, and by the way, ventilator, putting a patient like this on a ventilator is very profitable for the hospital. So the physicians might have said, well, we put him on a ventilator because we're not allowed not to withhold this kind of care. But the interesting thing is that if you look at the rates of patients who were put on ventilators in Manhattan, it is way, way higher than the rates of patients who were put on ventilators in upstate New York. And the law is the same in the entire state. The real issue is that there are lots and lots of ventilators in New York, and they will get used. Because when hospitals invest in things, they get used. If hospitals buy CT scanners, they will get used. If they invest in ICU beds, they will get used. If they find pulmonologists and they hire pulmonologists, those pulmonologists will have visits with physicians. And this is part of the problem, is that there are parts of this country where we have overinvested in the healthcare sector. We have poured money into the healthcare sector. We have built beds. Los Angeles, you can't go 5 miles without finding a hospital in Los Angeles. And the result is that there are parts of this country where people get huge amounts of care, especially at the end of life. Whether or not it's what they wanted, whether or not it really is going to help them, but because it's built, because it's there, it's going to get used. And so that's part of what's going on. And this has real effects for patients. It has real impact on patients. Now, it might be possible to sort of dismiss this story with this patient who had AIDS because, you know, he had AIDS and he's old and, you know, he was dying, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll give you a story about another patient who was not dying. This is a young woman in her 40s who was having anxiety attacks. She had a very bad home situation. She was having anxiety attacks where her heart would be racing, and so she would go to the hospital. So just to rule out that this was not really some kind of a heart problem, she was worked up by her physicians. They did a whole workup on her, and she had absolutely nothing wrong with her heart. She goes to the hospital again. She's got her heart is racing. She's having an anxiety attack. She says, "I'm having an anxiety attack." And she ended up being catheterized, which is a tube is snaked up your femoral artery up into the coronary arteries, and it's used to check on whether or not there's a blockage in the coronary arteries. And her records, I have her records, and what her records say is coronary artery dissected, which in ordinary terms means somebody poked a hole in her coronary artery. And she then really did have a heart problem, and she died on the table multiple times and was brought back. She had to be defibrillated several times. And they had to put a stent in to prop open her coronary artery, and now she really does have a heart problem because her heart was damaged by this. And the cruelest part of it is that in her record it says, do not accept checks from this patient because she's uninsured. So why did this happen to this patient? A charitable interpretation is that her doctors were really afraid that maybe she was having a heart attack. But nothing in her record suggests that she was having a heart attack. None of the blood tests show that she was having a heart attack. She was having an anxiety attack because her husband abuses her. So unnecessary care has real meaning for patients, real impact on patients' lives. So there are 80 million CT scans. I'm going to give you one more example of unnecessary care. And I'm telling these terrible stories, and I feel bad about telling terrible stories because the reality is that huge amounts of medicine are incredibly, incredibly helpful, incredibly good for patients. My father would not be alive without dialysis. He had to be on dialysis temporarily. Now, of course, he was on dialysis because he was taking a statin that made his kidneys fail, but dialysis saved his life. I have a friend whose son would not be alive without the surgery, the emergency surgery, because he had a malrotation of his bowel when he was a baby. And this emergency surgery saved his life. So many aspects of medicine are incredibly helpful. And most physicians and most nurses and most people involved in healthcare, I think, really want to help their patients. But even so, there is real harm that occurs when we get care that we don't need. So I want to just tell you a couple more examples. CT scans. We do 80 million CT scans a year in this country. That's one for almost every third person in this room. And the estimate is that a third of those CT scans are unnecessary. And they are done because mothers demand them. They are done because physicians sort of do them as a matter of course. They're done for any number of reasons. But those unnecessary CT scans are thought to cause 14,000 excess cancer deaths each year because they pack a lot of radiation. So unnecessary care really has an effect on patient. It matters to what happens to patients. And the question is, why is it happening? And it's happening for a lot of reasons. It is not doctors sitting there rubbing their hands together saying, another patient, another dollar. I mean, there's greedy doctors, just like there's greedy journalists, and there's greedy policy wonks, and there's greedy college administrators. But that's not the fundamental problem. It is that we get what we pay for. We pay for more care. We don't pay for better care. This is one of the biggest flaws in our system. We pay for more care. We don't pay for better care. You get paid if you do a good job or if you get to do a bad job. In fact, to some degree, hospitals get paid more for doing a bad job because if the patient ends up being rehospitalized, you get paid again, which is really crazy when you think about it. It is not just patient demand. Patients do demand all kinds of things. Patients go in with a cold and say, I want antibiotics, even though antibiotics don't do anything for viruses, which cause colds. Patients demand CT scans for their kids. Patients demand painkillers like Vioxx. One doctor told me about a patient who demanded Vioxx, which ended up killing a whole lot of people from heart attacks. Patients demand all kinds of things, but patient demand cannot account for the incredibly vast amount. It only accounts for a little bit of it. And another thing that is part of the problem is defensive medicine, that physicians are really worried that they're going to get sued. And they are worried, and they do get sued, and being sued is the pits. But one of the things that we see when we look around the country at how similar patients are treated is we see that similar patients are treated with a lot more care in places like Los Angeles and Manhattan and Miami than they are in places like Omaha or Sacramento or Seattle. Same patients, basically, but hugely different amounts of treatment. And physicians are worried all over the country about getting sued. So the problem is not just that physicians are worried about getting sued, because on top of that problem, giving care patients don't really need because you're worried they're going to sue you, on top of that problem is this variation in what happens to patients, similar patients in different parts of the country. And I'll give you a very specific example. And this is from a study that was done by colleagues of mine at Dartmouth, where they looked at what happened to patients who had a heart attack. And they looked at from the minute that patient was hospitalized with the heart attack over the period of a year, then 2 years, then 3 years. So if you were hospitalized, if you're a Medicare recipient and you were hospitalized for a heart attack in Salem, Oregon, you cost Medicare about $13,000 over the course of a certain period of time, a few months. Same patient hospitalized in Los Angeles, $20,000. Now, where did that $7,000 go, that extra $7,000 go? It wasn't that care is more expensive in Los Angeles or that Medicare pays more for each unit of service in Los Angeles. It's that people in Los Angeles got more care. They got more stuff. They got more drugs. They got more procedures. They got more visits with doctors. They got more days in the hospital. And here's the kicker. They had higher mortality in Los Angeles. So doctors in Los Angeles are worried about getting sued, but so are doctors in Salem, Oregon. So something else is going on. And one of the things that's going on is related to another healthcare zombie. So does anybody have an estimate for how much of medicine is based on valid science, on really good, well-documented science? And those who have already been asked this question don't get to answer. So who votes for most? Most care is based in good science. Who votes for 75%? Who votes for 50%? Who votes for 25%? Oh, you guys are on to me. It's something less than half. It's less than half. So what's the rest of it based on? Well, it's based on what we've always done. It's tradition. It's based on marketing by the drug industry. It's based on what's profitable. But it's not based on really good science. And so this is part of the problem, is that when I think about this sometimes. I think about this in terms of getting on an airplane. What if the pilot came back from the cockpit and said, I know what half of those dials mean. I know what half of those dials are for, but I still think I can fly the plane. And that's kind of what we're doing. So part of the problem is so much of medicine is really not based on valid science. We don't really know what works in medicine and what doesn't work in medicine. Sometimes we really do know. But a lot of the time we don't really know. And so all kinds of things can drive what happens to patients, like local medical culture can drive what happens to patients. We always use a Swan-Ganz catheter in this hospital. Well, do you have any evidence that this expensive device that's invasive actually helps patients? Well, no, but we always use one, whereas the hospital down the street doesn't use one. So that's another part of what's driving the unnecessary care and driving the huge amount of care that we're delivering. And part of why we don't know is because we've let the pharmaceutical industry pay for 80% of the clinical trials that get done in this country. We've left it to this one industry to pay for the stuff that we really need, which is really good information about what works and what doesn't. So part of what the legislation does is it says we now need to pay as a society for this kind of information. And guess who is lobbying very, very hard and trying to persuade the American public that this kind of research amounts to rationing? The pharmaceutical industry. So we absolutely have to start paying for the kind of science that really will tell us what works and what doesn't. That's part of what we need. I think about this a lot, about this sort of lack of science, and it's incredibly important. I mean, you know, we like to think back on things that physicians used to do, like bloodletting, as incredibly barbaric and primitive. But some of what we do now is based on no more good science than some of that. That was based on an idea of how the body worked. And now we do things that are based on our ideas of how the body works. And so we really have to do this kind of science. So we need more evidence. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit disoriented because I actually really changed this talk for you guys. Because I wanted to make sure that the people who have heard me talk are not hearing the same thing. So we need to be able to know what works and what doesn't. We also need a sort of science of healthcare delivery. We need a sense of how do you take patients and how do you sort of make sure that they get the best care that you can give them. We also need to find out what kind of care patients really want. And believe it or not, we don't find out what care patients really, really want. In this age of consumer-driven healthcare and patient-centered care, we still have to learn to find out what it is patients really want. And I'll tell you a story that illustrates this. And some of you have already heard this story. And this is a story about an elderly man who had many things going wrong with him all at the same time. His kidneys were failing. He had diabetes. He had obstructive pulmonary disease. He had heart failure. He had liver disease. And he was demented. And he had had an implantable defibrillator put in a couple of months before this friend of mine, Peter Kibbe, saw him. Peter Kibbe is a primary care doctor, and he had seen this man several times in the hospital. So the man was in the hospital yet again for one of the many chronic illnesses that he had. And the man had this defibrillator put in 2 months before. And for those who don't know what this is a little device that's put in the chest. And it's supposed to make the heart beat properly, beat regularly when it starts to beat irregularly. And it's sort of like a small internal version of the external paddles that you see on television in ER and things like that. So the man was sitting there, and Peter was examining him. And in the middle of the examination, the man grabs his chest and begins to scream in pain, and then looks at Peter and says, "Stop it!" Because his defibrillator had gone off, and it packed a wallop, and he thought that Peter was shocking him. He thought Peter was somehow causing the pain in his chest, because he didn't remember that he'd had this thing implanted 2 months before. So what had happened was the cardiologist had said to the family, his heart is not beating regularly, and if we want his heart to keep beating and we don't want it to stop, we need to put this device in his chest. And at the time, Peter had said, you know, this might not be the best thing because this thing is going to keep going off repeatedly as he's dying. And what the family did is they sort of saw the cardiologist as the good guy who wanted to save their family member, and Peter is the bad guy, Dr. Death, who wanted to deny care. And the family was poor, and their family member was on Medicare, and so there was this sort of sense that they wanted to get all the care they possibly could. So the cardiologist was seen as the saving doctor, and Peter was seen as the bad doctor. Or it's possible that this family actually wanted this guy to suffer, but I don't think that's what was going on. And I know stories about family members who do want patients to suffer. So Peter lost that battle, and the defibrillator was put in, and it proceeded to go off several more times over the period of the time that this man was hospitalized until he finally died. And it gave him terrible pain every single time. And what I think about is, had that family really understood what the trade-offs were, what was really at stake, and what was possible here, and had they had an opportunity to really understand this, would they have made this decision? And the decision had real consequences for somebody that they loved. It made him die in pain. But it also had consequences for the rest of us who pay for Medicare, because that's a $50,000 device. It's a very, very expensive device. So we need to find ways to help patients really understand what the trade-offs are in medicine. And it turns out, when you do help patients understand trade-offs, they turn out to be more conservative. They turn out to be less interested in invasive things a lot of the time. Now, some patients are going to say, I want everything. I want knee surgery multiple times, and I want hip replacement, and I want everything. But most patients are actually more conservative and more cautious. And so one of the things that we really need to do in healthcare reform, and this is also in the legislation, is find ways to help patients really understand those trade-offs and to find ways for them to have a relationship with a physician or a nurse or both that allows them to share decisions. Because right now, many, many decisions about things that are elective, about things like this defibrillator, about whether or not you're going to have bypass surgery, about whether or not you're going to have knee surgery, about whether or not you're going to have a hysterectomy, whether or not you're going to have a PSA test. Many of these things are decided by the physician and governed by the physician's opinion, not by what the patient really wants. So this has to be a really key part of how we go forward in healthcare reform. The couple of last things, and then I will let you go or let you ask questions. I should have told you to ask me questions as we go along. The supply problem. If they build it, patients will come. If you build ICU units, more patients will end up in the ICU. If you get more CT scans, more patients will get CT scanners, whether or not that's the right thing to do. And so we have to find ways to pay differently so that we don't keep building up the system. We don't keep building up capacity, especially in places where capacity is always already very, very high. I have a friend who jokes that you could ship a third of the doctors in L.A. to Africa and improve the average health of both continents. And that's not true of Omaha, by the way. Omaha is pretty conservative in that regard. So what do we need to do? Well, for one thing, we need to make sure we eat lots of fruits and vegetables. As Michael Pollan, who's a wonderful food writer, says, eat good food, eat lots of plants. So I think that's very good advice. But we also need to go on a 12-step program vis-a-vis medicine. And one of them is we have to admit we have a problem. So no, we do not have the best health care in the world. Yes, we do have a cost problem, and we need to start making changes. Number two, we need to start paying for that research, that really crucial clinical research involving patients that'll tell us what works in medicine, what doesn't work in medicine, and for which patients. Number three, we need to stop paying for the volume of care. We need to start paying for value, not volume. Volume of care means the amount of services. We pay for more care, not better care, and we have to find ways to pay for better care. And we're starting to do that. The legislation does a little tiny bit on doing that. It begins to address it. And I had a very interesting conversation with one of the healthcare groups here in Omaha with Allegiant, and they know they need to start making changes. They know it, and they're starting to make those changes, and it's very, very hard. It's changing the culture of medicine. Number four, we need to recognize that both our money and our lives are at stake here. We have this bloated, unscientific, inefficient system that not only is affecting our wallets, it's affecting our bodies. It's your money and your life. And we need to become engaged as patients. So when you face something elective, when you face an elective surgery, gallbladder surgery, when you face an elective test, a PSA test, ask your doctor to really walk through all of the alternatives. And if your doctor isn't explaining it to you in a way that you really understand, ask a nurse. And if a nurse isn't really explaining it to you, then go on the web and see if you can find a patient decision aid. Now, unfortunately, the web is kind of an unreliable place to get information about medicine. But see if somebody can give you a patient decision aid and really make sure that you know that the decision is yours, that your values and what you care about really matters in this process. And if you're doubtful about something and you feel like you're being pushed, stop. Get more information. And if you're really lucky that you have a doctor that's really good at explaining things, then hold on to them really hard. And if you're really lucky and you have a really great primary care doctor, hold on. Because your primary care doctor is absolutely key to you having good health and to coordinating what happens to you. But most of all, I think we have to all remember something really important, and that is the idea that there, unlike being too rich and too thin, there is such a thing as having too much medicine. And just because it's new and just because there's more of it doesn't mean it's necessarily the right thing for us. And I am very hopeful that we actually are on the road to reforming the system and to having improved care. It's not going to happen overnight. It's probably going to be really awful for a while. There's going to be a lot of tumult. It's going to be very difficult. But I think ultimately we're going to end up getting a better system that cares for us in better ways. So with that, thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Shannon Brownlee, the Swartz Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, and author of Overtreated, Why Too Much Medication is Making Us Sicker and Poorer. She spoke on the topic, The Cost of Healthcare. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, October 27, 2010, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Carmen Steele, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the College of St. Mary, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, and podcasts of selected Noon Forum programs are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.